The new Renegade University is here, featuring a new website, a new platform, new faculty, brand new courses, reboots of old courses, our own independent social media platform called The Quad, which is free of censors from Facebook or Twitter or the government. We also have what we're calling office hours, where you can talk one-on-one or in groups with our instructors. We also continue to have our very popular RU Live events, which include weekends, seminars, and one-night events all across the country. To check out the new RU, go to renegadeuniversity.com. Right now, as part of our grand launch sale, you can get 30 to 40% off new memberships. So again, to experience the new RU, go to renegadeuniversity.com. This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. My guest this week is the child of black nationalist radicals in Detroit. He's a PhD and intellectual and an expert on African-American history and culture. He's a documentary filmmaker. He's a top-flight collector of African diaspora art. And believe it or not, he's teaching America's children. This is my interview with Kamasi Hill. I am sitting in Rogers Park. It's a neighborhood in the north side of Chicago, in an apartment that is one of my favorite places on earth. It is my friend Kamasi Hill's apartment, which is very much also a museum, an art museum, devoted to what you call, right, African diaspora art. Is that how you still term it?
I would say, yes, African diaspora art. I would also say that the vast majority of the art is made by contemporary artists of African descent. So most of the people who are making the art in my apartment are still alive, and they're people that I've met and know and have made connections with.
Yeah.
So that's the difference. A lot of people just buy art, and it doesn't make a difference if they're dead or alive. I actually want to meet you first.
How come?
I think it's important that people understand the role of art in their local neighborhood. And how local artists make a difference. You're supporting the economy of your local neighborhood, of your area. You are ensuring that the story, you know, of your and the stories of the people who live in the neighborhood are being told and celebrated and honored. You're curating the experiences of the people in your neighborhood. Because art is a reflection. Art at its best is a reflection of who we are and how we live and how we navigate the world. I don't care if it's a flower, you know, in a meadow, or if it's, you know, the neighborhood pool hall and the dude who's, you know, sipping on bourbon while, you know what I'm saying?
Yep. He's,
you're curating the experiences of the people who, you're honoring the voices of the people who live where you live.
Yeah, but wait, this is not just artists from around the way. This is artists.
No, most of these artists on these walls live within a 5 to 15 mile radius.
Oh, they really are.
They're here.
Oh,
they're in Chicago.
I didn't know that.
70% of the artists that I buy from are local Chicago.
But you have a lot of artists who are from Atlanta. My favorite one here, Najee Dorsey, is from Atlanta, right?
Yeah. So Najee Dorsey is originally from Little Rock, Arkansas.
Okay.
His base is Columbus, Georgia. He lived in Atlanta for a number of years. Columbus is just cheaper to have, you know, art gallery and, you know, where he does his work. My second favorite artist is the guy who makes the art from broken vinyl shards.
Mm-hmm. My second favorite too.
You know, he's in Indianapolis.
What's his name?
His name is Walter Loben Hamilton. But most of these guys, most of these, the men and women who I buy from are right here in Chicago.
I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's not what you're doing as a, or maybe it is, maybe I'm wrong. Like, didn't seem like that was your primary interest as a curator, right? It's African diaspora.
No, my primary, you asked me why is it important that I buy from contemporary artists.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's right.
Yeah. So like,
my bad.
No, if you're asking me what's the purpose of me buying art, then that's a different question. But like, why am I buying art from contemporary artists? It's because, and you know, people who are alive, is because I think it's important that you support folks around you. And you don't have to go far. It's like, you know, most neighborhoods have.
Well, it helps to live in Chicago.
It does help to live in Chicago. But I guarantee you, no matter where you are, if you're in a major urban area or a major city in America, there's somebody who's painting something, who's drawing something, who's creating something, you know.
But it's also, it's almost exclusively African-American.
Yes, it is almost exclusively contemporary black artists of African descent.
Right.
You know, so that's, it's almost exclusively that. And of course, we can talk about why, you know, how that, you know, how that particular thing plays out in my own personal narrative.
Oh, we will. So when you enter the house, the apartment, it needs to be described. It's unlike anything, I promise you, you've ever seen, audience. I mean, how many pieces do you have in here?
Over 250.
And there's several in storage too, right?
Yeah.
So over 250 total. Yeah. And it's like a 2-bedroom apartment.
Mm-hmm.
So as you might imagine, pretty much every square foot has a piece of art in it, and it is.
Yeah. There's no wall. There's no wall space that can fit something more than 11 by 14. I mean, there's not there. I can't fit anything 18 by 24. Not even 16 by 20 on these walls. It's pretty much.
Now your old apartment, which was bigger.
Yeah, it was bigger.
Bigger wall space. Yeah. That's the.
That's why I was in there for those walls.
That was amazing.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you walk in, and I mean, it's just spectacular. We'll put photos. Is that right?
Up it's on fine.
The website.
It's
fine. Yeah. Because people got to see this. But it's like everything from. There's of course a lot of paintings. Oil, all kinds of paintings. Then you have lots of sculpture. You have African masks. You have, and then you have your new thing since I've been here is you have a lot of very contemporary, what would you call the toy figurine thing?
Yeah, sort of toys, figurines. So those are, there's an artist that is from the South Side of Chicago named Heber Brantley who wanted to create toys and dolls that resembled people who looked like him. And as a black man who was 6'8" from the South Side of Chicago and one of the top basketball cities in the country, right? Mm-hmm. Or the top high school basketball company. Everybody was like, you're 6'8", you should play. And he's like, no, I want to read comic books. I want to draw. I want to paint. And, you know, thankfully he stuck with it. But he noticed that there were not a lot of dolls and toys that looked like him. And so he created something called Flyboy, where he used the essentially the uniform of the famous war veterans, the war troop, I would say, the Air Force troop, the Tuskegee Airmen. Mm-hmm. And he created these dolls. So these are kind of high end toy figurines because they're in the 3 and 4 figures. I mean, it's not like something you could buy, you know, from where there's no Toys R Us anymore.
That's right. They have I was telling you before we started rolling, they have like a Japanese aesthetic.
They do.
Right. It's sort of based on the Japanese dolls. Not that I know much about that, but when I've been in like.
Definitely anime, kind of had that anime. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But so you got that, then you've got, I mean, you just have everything, but it's high art, it's low art, so-called.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you have any medium art, but it's, people look at the pictures. It's remarkable. Like what you've been doing. I don't even know how you've pulled it off, but are you still planning on just keeping this, or do you want to like give it away and have it so it's displayed publicly? Cause you're hoarding, motherfucker.
I am.
You're hoarding and you're keeping this from the world. You're like this beautiful art. You feel any guilt about that?
No,
that I'm shaming you.
So I do have a will. Oh. And
thank you for putting me in it.
Yeah. And as of right now, it could change it, but as of right now, the art goes to two of the institutions that I graduated from, and we're probably going to talk about
Howard.
Both of them are HBCUs, Howard University and ITC.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's
Interdenominational ITC? Theological Center. It's the first historically black college that specifically was designed to train people who are interested in going into ministry and religious studies. Mm-hmm. And for your audience, there are about 109 historically black colleges and universities mm-hmm. in America. And there are various from rural to urban, but most of them are in the South and on the Eastern Seaboard. There are very few West Coast. In fact, I don't think there's a West Coast HBCU.
I've thought about that, but you're right. Yeah.
But most of them are in the South, and most of them are on the East Coast.
You know why? Reconstruction.
Reconstruction, absolutely. Freedmen's Bureau, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Of course. And the Black Church. So you're talking.
Yeah. Right.
So you're talking about, I mean, you know, places like Wilberforce University got money both from the Freedmen's Bureau and the AME Church. It's mm-hmm. an AME school, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, William Wilberforce himself, he's famous, you know, Christian. He wrote the song "Amazing Grace." you know what I'm saying?
So yeah, it's in like Ohio.
In Ohio, yep, absolutely. Yep. Mm-hmm. But you have you know, places like Shorter, really small black colleges in places like Texas, you know, mm-hmm. that historically black churches have funded and really kept alive. Mm-hmm. I'm curating primarily the story of a segment of the black experience. Mm-hmm. I don't like to say the black experience. There's no the black mm-hmm. experience, but just a segment, just one glimpse of the black experience. And I want to be able to give this art, to pass this down to institutions that helped me develop intellectually. And hopefully they can do something with it. You know, I don't know if you ever saw this documentary called The Art of the Steal.
Art of the Steal?
Art of the Steal. Uh-uh. You got to see this documentary. This documentary is about a cat by the name of Dr. Albert Barnes. Mm-mm. Immigrant.
Is this the Barnes Collection?
The Barnes Collection. Do you know how that? How it came about? Uh-uh. Barnes was a boxer.
Oh,
who boxed his way through medical school. He earned his, that's how he earned his money, through medical school. Huh. He goes to medical school, he graduates from medical school, and he develops a patent that helps alleviate STDs in babies when they're born. He sells this patent for millions of dollars. But he did something unintentionally very smart. He moved all of that money and he spent his summers in Paris before the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. So he moved his money to Paris. He didn't know. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm sure he didn't know that this. So he had money. But while he was in Paris, he met these young French artists who no one knew about. They were just young dudes named Matisse, mm-hmm. young dudes named Picasso. You know,
I see.
He bought all of this post-impressionist art from his friends.
Yep.
Came back to Philadelphia with all of this art. He had all this money too, because you know he was able. He wasn't impacted by the stock market. Mm-hmm. And he went to where Kobe Bryant played basketball, Lower Merion, Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And he establishes it was his home, but essentially like mine.
That's
but
right.
He made a art gallery out of his home, but he also made an educational institution. Mm-hmm. Long story short, they end up stealing it. The city of Philadelphia, once the state, you know, comes in,
I didn't know that.
They stole it, man. They stole it right from under him.
I know it moved. I didn't know it was because of his.
Oh, no. In his will, because he didn't have any children, in his will, he bequeaths his collection to what I am trying to bequeath to a black college. What's the black college in Philadelphia? What? Lincoln University.
He did?
He gave them. And when they did the appraisal of his art, it was $25 billion.
Yeah.
And you're talking about a small, obscure black college in Philadelphia. They had no clue what to do with it. $25 billion for HBCU, who's basically their operational budget probably was never more than about $12 or $13 million a year.
Damn.
And so that's where the drama begins. Once he dies and he gives his collection, he bequeaths the collection to the HBCU. Oh, they're like, oh, we can take this shit. Hmm. So all of the people who wanted his collection start to put their hands on it. And eventually, you know, it's now it's the Barnes collection is in a building on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway in Philadelphia. But they stole it. The city of Philadelphia stole it.
They snatched it from your people.
Exactly.
Man, you got to watch out for the white devil. Speaking of white devil.
Speaking of white devils.
And people who don't like them. So people may be wondering, okay, so you're in the apartment of this dude who collects African diaspora art. And I'm telling you, this, I've never seen anything like this, any collection, any museum of art, of African American art or anything like that ever. Like, I just, you will be hard pressed to find. Have you seen a museum of contemporary African American art that rivals what you have in this building right now? Where?
Right here in Chicago.
Where?
Patrick McCoy, one of my mentors, Daniel Parker, one of my mentors, all of the master collectors that I've learned from.
Oh, okay.
Have Patrick McCoy, his
private collections,
collections
in their houses,
1,600 pieces of
art. Well, that's why I don't know, because they're private. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, you mean like so public? You mean public?
Well, anything. No, but you're you're a bunch of hoarders, basically.
We are. That's what we do.
Man. You got to let it be free. Let the people.
We like
it.
To call ourselves curators, but yeah, hoarder. I'll take it.
Okay.
Take
so,
it.
But it's gonna end up. So it's all gonna end up with either Howard or.
As of right now, it could change.
Okay. All right. So people are thinking, all right, you're in this apartment in Chicago. This dude who collects all this black art, and he went to Howard University. Guess even deeper. His name's Kamasi.
Why the hell is this white dude in my neighborhood?
In my apartment? Why are you talking to me anyway? We'll tell them why you're talking to me. So, but it gets even deeper, people. So Kamasi grew up in a special family. An unusual mm-hmm. family. He was born into a church. You want to tell him what that church was?
Sure. The church is called the Shrine of the Black Madonna Pan-African Orthodox Christian Church.
What the hell is that, they're saying?
Well, so...
Now, I had actually studied it because I studied black nationalism, but I didn't live it like you did.
Yeah, so, you know, what you have in the 50s and 60s is, you know, you have this new emerging cadre of young black radicals who view a couple of things. First of all, they view the long swath of history of the black experience as unkept promises of democracy. Mm-hmm. They view the state as hugely problematic, mm-hmm. constantly intervening in the lives of the people. Mm-hmm. But they also view the civil rights movement as moving extremely too slow and moving into an area that's a little too conservative, politically conservative mm-hmm. for their mm-hmm. taste. And
well, and they were integrationists.
And they're integrationists.
And your people weren't feeling that.
So my parents were young college students in the city of Detroit at a time
where... You hear that, people? Detroit. He's from Detroit, too.
Where, you know, they're trying to make sense of the world as young people around them. Mm-hmm. My father comes from a family of... Southern. My father's born in Martinsville, Virginia, but raised in Detroit by two middle school educated working class black, you know, people. My grandfather was a mechanic for the state of for the city of Detroit.
Okay.
He worked on the police cars.
That's
what he did. That's
sparking me. That's what he did. Working for the devil. Okay.
Exactly. He worked on police. He was a mechanic.
Damn.
And my grandmother was a part-time nurse, but for the most part, she was a homemaker. Mm-hmm. But my grandfather was also a World War II veteran. Mm. So he had some benefits. He didn't completely benefit from the GI Bill. We know that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, he had some benefits from his experience being in the segregated barracks when he was stationed in the Philippines in the army. Mm. So my father was essentially raised by a lower middle class family in Southwest Detroit. So he came from means. You know, he went to one of the best high schools in the city of Detroit, Cass Technical High School.
Cass, yeah.
And he became politically aware at that time. Like, he started to see what was going on around him in Detroit, the politics of the city, which was an emerging a thriving black community since mm-hmm. the 1930s. But he didn't see himself reflected in the political leaders and the political infrastructure. And he met my mother, who also grew up in the city of Detroit, but she grew up very poor. She grew up in the Brewster's Projects. Mm. So, and she grew up as the youngest of 10. Her parents were from South Carolina. My mother had two dresses that she wore every day to school. And then something really unfortunate happened. My grandfather worked for the Chrysler plant. And at that time, you know, this was, even though this was post the jungle by Upton Sinclair, you know, mm-hmm. the factory still didn't have a lot of safety mechanisms. So the soot from the factories got into my grandfather's system, tuberculosis, and he passed it down to all 10 of his children, except for my mother. Hmm. So my mother grew up in a house where my grandfather was sick. All of her brothers and sisters were sick. Her mother had to scrub the floors of folks and Jewish folks in the neighboring East Side community because there was no income because everybody's in the hospital. And my mother's in a house by herself. So my father comes from this lower middle class family. My mother comes from dirt, mm-hmm. abject poverty. Mm-hmm. But they meet in this interesting nexus, right? Because they both belong to this church because they're politically curious about what is happening to black people and what black people can do in response to that. And this is a church. This is not a civic organization. Mm-hmm. Albert Clegg, who's the pastor of the church, is interesting because he's a very, very fair-skinned man. He goes to Oberlin in Ohio. And while he's at Oberlin, he becomes politically aware. But he ends up in San Francisco at a church called the All People's Fellowship. And the pastor is a man by the name of Howard Thurman, who's a very famous philosopher and theologian.
Yep.
Him and Howard Thurman is this black mystic. He's really kind of obscure black dude that most people don't know about by name. But if you've ever read anything by Martin Luther King, Martin Luther King literally plagiarizes entire sections from Howard Thurman's writings. Yep. And Howard Thurman wrote over 17 books, right? Yeah. And Howard Thurman, by the way, Martin Luther King gets his PhD from Boston University. Howard Thurman was the dean of the Boston University Divinity School. So he's interacting with Thurman. So when Albert Clay becomes politically aware, he's in San Francisco at the All People's Fellowship Church with Howard Thurman, who has this kind of interracial, you know, kind of ecumenical mm-hmm. church. Mm-hmm. Because the church, while it's Christian, he has Buddhists there. He's just this really kind of interesting, mystical dude. And Clegg is like, but black people are catching hell. You know, how can I be in San Francisco in this Bay Area church with all of these liberals who have this kind of eclectic, ecumenical, you know, take on religion, and you're so disconnected from not simply the folks in Detroit, but the folks across that bridge in Oakland, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Who are catching hell. Albert Clegg says, I can't deal with this anymore. So he goes to Detroit, back to Detroit, and he pastors a church called Plymouth Congregational Church, and he begins involved in politics. But Plymouth Congregational Church is a white church. And so Clegg brilliantly takes everything that he's learned from Thurman and Plymouth and Oberlin, and he merges it with black power and black nationalism. And he creates this church called the Shrine of the Black Madonna, Pan-African Orthodox Christian Church. And he comes up with creeds and models and theologies centered in this idea of black theology. And black theology is not a well-known subject. It became well-known during the first Obama run, when it was revealed that he was a member of a church very similar to mine mm-hmm. that preached a black theological doctrine. And that's when the world, at least America, first heard about black theology. But black theology had been being preached in some black churches since the 1960s.
This is your friend, new. Jeremiah Wright.
Yes.
That church and that whole controversy.
Absolutely.
Right? Yep.
Mm-hmm. So, and black theology simply says that black people have a... black people in America in particular have a read on the Bible that is very consistent with the Latin American theologians of the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, the Latin American Jewish, Catholic theologians, mm-hmm. liberation theology.
Yeah, right. The socialist, left-wing liberation theology within the Catholic Church. Right.
So liberation theology is essentially a neo-Marxist read on Jesus's ministry. It's not even really the Bible per se. It's really Jesus. Mm-hmm. It's really liberation theology argues that God comes in the person of an oppressed first century Palestinian Jew.
Mm-hmm.
So if God comes in the person of someone who's in a colonized state, you know, walking around here in the flesh, then that means God must identify with the oppressed. What black theologians come and say is that who are the most oppressed in America? It's black folks. Mm-hmm. So if God is coming in the person of a first century Palestinian Jew who's identifying with the oppressed, when black people look at the Bible, we see a black Jesus who identifies with black people because black people are the oppressed. And here's the thing, the same power structure, white power structure, this is why Albert Clay goes deeper. The same white power structure that killed Jesus is the same white power structure that's trying to kill black folks in America.
Okay.
Clegg did something different than the liberation theologians. See, the liberation theologians say, yes, Jesus was oppressed and he was killed by a state, right? The state of Rome, right? Colonizing the people of Palestine. But they don't racialize it.
Right.
Clegg racializes it. He says, no, it's not simply that Rome killed Jesus. Rome killed a black man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
My parents met in this church, had a very profound connection with this theology, got married, and then 2 years later, here I come.
Born into the church.
Born into that church.
Just like me. Exactly. I was born into a church, just a different kind.
Absolutely. We were born in, both you and I, and this is how one of the reasons why we connected.
Right.
Came up in families that had a particular political bent towards understanding the relationship of power. Like we had a very, your parents being communists,
mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And mm-hmm. my parents being black nationalists.
Right. Radicals. Radicals, isolated, deeply weird, unusual. There's just, I mean, even within black nationalism, the shrine of the Black Madonna is, I mean, it'll show up in the textbooks, but it's a minor player in that, even in that history, right?
And
for my parents, it was like this Trotskyist sect that even among socialists was pretty weird and small, yeah.
There's a literature waiting to be written. I would say there's a comprehensive book waiting to be
written. I was going
to
say there's a film. Needs to be made about the history of the children of black radicals. Come on, so you got any ideas about who should do that?
We can talk about that
in a second.
But what I was saying is I've never seen a text on American religious radicalism.
Okay.
A comprehensive text. There have been, you know, because when you talk about American religious radicalism, it shows up everywhere. It shows up in Catholic sects. It shows up in Protestant sects. It shows up in Islamic sects. You know what I'm saying? There are all of these, whether they're small storefront mm-hmm. institutions or whether they're large, American religious radicalism has always been a running thread. And even if you want to argue to a certain extent, the social gospel movement, there's a kind of radicalism to that. And that's 19th century, right?
I'll throw Mormonism at you. Right?
Absolutely.
Right?
I'll throw Jehovah's Witnesses at
you.
Yeah,
oh, I mean, definitely.
You know, I'm like...
Definitely.
I mean, there's a reason why Kingdom Halls don't have windows.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. You know what I'm saying?
And there's a reason why the state cracked their heads
Absolutely.
Open, too. The Mormons, certainly,
Absolutely.
And others.
Absolutely.
Many others. Yeah.
So there is this... I mean, and you can even... I mean, to me, one of the most underappreciated forms of American religious radicalism, theologically speaking, was Jim Jones.
People's Temple.
People's Temple.
Did I ever tell you about my connection to that?
No.
My neighborhood in Berkeley, growing up, supplied something like half the people who went to People's Temple. It was in southwest mm-hmm. Berkeley, and it was just a mostly black but kind of integrated neighborhood. And for some reason, well, various reasons, he recruited a bunch of people from there. So yeah, my neighborhood was deeply affected by that. Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously we know the impact.
1978, for those of you don't know, the massacre at People's Temple in, what was the country?
Guyana.
Guyana, right.
But But people need to listen to what Jim Jones was actually.
Okay, tell us what. Why?
Well, I mean, well, here's the thing. I mean, Jim Jones
was a radical.
He was a radical. Mm-hmm. Well, he understood that Jim Jones had a kind of liberation bent. Because liberation theology, not only does it critique the state politically, it critiques the state economically. It's a neo-Marxist theology. Hmm. But Jim Jones, that's what Jim Jones was. He was dealing with poor people, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The state has failed
exactly.
you economically.
Yep. Yep.
So, and he's not saying the state has failed you economically because, you know, he's offering a critique of Milton Friedman or Adam Smith. He's coming from he's looking at the Bible. He's saying, look at the history of the Bible. Look at the most vulnerable people in the Bible. Particularly the New Testament, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're all economically exploited.
Yeah.
And look at your condition. So what I'm saying is, like, there is a strain of American religious radicalism that always shows up. And I don't think we talk enough about the ways in which people have been impacted by these respective movements. And how they've shaped American identity in many ways. And that's when, I guess that's a good segue to talk about Born in the Struggle.
I'll just, before we do that, you've never told me about that. That seems indisputable to me. And are you sure there's never been a book written about that?
Not a comprehensive book about very...
Right.
I mean, Father Divine and Daddy Grace.
Yeah.
There have been books written about them.
Peoples. Yeah.
But like...
There's been a part of a book written about Father Sweet Daddy Grace, as you know.
Absolutely. But what I'm saying is like... A lot of times, you know, we kind of, I'm going to use this term, we kind of ghettoize, you know, black and white. I mean, we segregate them. We do that with everything. Like, no
kidding.
Did put really? Them in the black Protestant, black evangelicals, even when you look at what their fundamental belief systems are, ain't a whole lot different than white evangelicals. Mm-hmm. Now, they differ socially on policy and things of that nature, but in terms of fundamental belief system. So don't make it seem like folks are just completely like on two opposite ends of the spectrum.
The theological content, I think you're right, is very similar. Of course, there's massive cultural...
I believe in Jesus.
There's cultural differences are massive.
There's liturgical differences.
Mm-hmm.
There's social differences and there's cultural differences. Theologically,
yeah.
Not a lot of difference.
Right, agree. So you were about to segue to something. What was that?
I was going
to
say, so...
Oh, to,
you know,
to a movie.
Yeah, so growing up in this church, even though I was only in the church and my parents were only in the church briefly, black nationalism was all around me. Black cultural nationalism, black religious nationalism, black political nationalism. You know, these nationalistic ideas and beliefs are around me all the time. A big part of that is because of what the Shrine did. And one of the things that the people don't realize with the Shrine, the members of the Shrine did, was they got a black mayor elected in the city of Detroit that had never been...
You're talking about Coleman Young?
I'm talking about Coleman Young.
How was the Shrine involved in that?
Because they created... the Shrine of the Black Madonna members were responsible for developing something called the Black Slate. And the Black Slate was literally a platform, and it was on a flyer, and they went around to different black neighborhoods and they said, these are the candidates that we're supporting. This is the black, you support the black slate, and that's black nationalists. We're closing ranks.
Yep.
We are supporting our own.
Yep.
We're being self-determining, and we are creating the world in which we want to live in, the community in which we want to live.
We're going to create a black city.
Mm-hmm. And
they pretty much did.
Right. And now Coleman Young, in all fairness to him, ran a very smart campaign because he ran on one issue.
Was it police brutality?
Stress, exactly.
Yeah.
So for those of you
after the famous riots.
At the famous riots in 1967, the city of Detroit instituted a program called STRESS. And I can't remember the acronym, but it's essentially four cops to a police car.
Right.
And it was a reign of terror in the black community in Detroit.
Yep.
And a lot of people were victimized as a result of it. And Coleman Young stepped on the scene, a former Tuskegee Airman, right?
I didn't know that. Was he?
Oh, yeah. Makes a former sense. Tuskegee Airman. And if any of your viewers ever want to see a brilliant black man who's confronting Joseph McCarthy, because he was accused of commenting, watch, there should be a YouTube video somewhere.
Did not know this.
Yeah, Coleman Young goes head up with him. And some of the Southern Dixiecrats who were in, yeah, because they keep on calling him a nigra. And he's like, no, the word is negro. I mean, you know, Coleman Young was a very brash, for those of you who don't know, Coleman Young was a very brash, Southern black man who just was like guttural, like just didn't care.
And he knew how to fly a plane and shoot
exactly,
a gun.
Exactly, and shoot a gun, absolutely. So he ran on one issue. I'm going to eliminate stress.
Okay.
Shrine of the Black Madonna, all these young people at this church come in and say, okay, we're going to rally around that issue, create a black slate, and we're going to get you elected.
And they did.
And they did.
So do a little piece on just sort of black nationalism for those who aren't familiar with the history, you know, just break down the various strains with the black nationalism and where the shrine fits in.
Sure. So there's a range of black nationalist thought that goes all the way back to the 19th century. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what you have is kind of like three phases of black nationalism within the past, I would say, 130 years. You have the classical black nationalists of the 19th century, people like Edward Wilmot Blyden, Henry McNeil Turner. These were all racemen, churchmen, who believed that black people had not only a right to assert themselves in the world, but they had a kind of spiritual, you know, connection to black identity. Mm-hmm. So they would use, Edward Wilmot Blyden was the first person to say, God is a Negro, right? And the reference that Edward Wilmot Blyden and people like Henry McNeil Turner, who was also a bishop in the AME church, what they used was Psalm 68:3, which says, Ethiopia shall stretch her hands unto thee. So they looked for these. It's an interesting way that they did it, because they looked for the Bible, which historically people have always said is a slave master's text. No, they looked specifically for the parts of the Bible that spoke to black identity, African identity. And they said, we have a God-given right, right, to own our identity because it's in the Bible. And this is where the origins of these classical black nationalists come out of. I would say the other person to me that is the most, I would say the person that everyone needs to know about, who is the first kind of classical black nationalist in text, is a man by the name of David Walker. Okay. David Walker wrote a book called the appeal to the colored citizens of the world. He's the first person in writing to articulate a kind of classical black religious nationalism.
Yep.
And he argues in that book in very staunch ways that black people need to kill their slave owners.
That's right.
That America is black. David Walker says in the book, America is more our land than the whites because our blood has enriched the soil. Mm-hmm. You know, and he mentions Africa constantly, and he fuses Africa with the Bible. It's a really kind of eclectic mix of black Christianity, white Christianity, which he critiques. He makes a distinction between white people practicing Christianity and black Christianity. And of course, you know, they're only a generation or two disconnected from Africa. So they have this kind of interesting symbolic relationship with Africa and Christianity and the Bible. So those are the classic black nationalists of the 19th century.
What about Martin Delaney? What do you do?
Martin Delaney as well.
I was waiting for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Martin Delaney.
So the thing for me, I mean, the reason that I've always been attracted to black nationalism, even though I'm neither black nor a nationalist, I'm not anti-black, but I'm anti-nationalist, but I nonetheless... And I'm not a hypocrite on this. I'm talking to the audience now. You got to stay with me here. Now, black nationalism to me has always been very important in this country and for my politics, because what David Walker did was, by declaring war, you're eliminating the integrationist alternative. You're eliminating the assimilationist alternative. You are saying, we're not doing business with you people. This is a fight. And to me, that is...
And what he's doing is not what Douglas is doing.
Exactly.
Douglas is appealing.
Exactly.
To the federal government.
And to whites generally.
To change their minds about black people.
Whereas
exactly.
The black nationalists from all the way from David Walker, all the way through Malcolm X and on is never...
They're not concerned about white people.
Exactly. That's the thing about black nationalists. I've been trying to tell everybody is like, they don't give a fuck about us. And that's exactly what we want.
Not at all.
Rather than constantly worrying about what white people are thinking, what white people are doing, assuming that white people determine the destiny of black people, to me is the soul, the core of conservatism within black politics that has just been deadly.
I mean,
and that's why black nationalism has always been to me like this breath of liberatory fresh air.
And so the second wave of black nationalism comes about in the early 20th century with people like Marcus Garvey, Elijah Muhammad. And what they're arguing, very similarly, they're using religion, but they're also saying, we want our own land. Marcus Garvey says it. Where's the black man's land? Where's the black man's army? Where's, you know, Elijah Muhammad is saying, we need our own land. We're not waiting on the government. Marcus Garvey, Elijah Muhammad, do not go after white philanthropists, the federal government. They're not appealing to institutions outside of the black community to do for themselves, right?
And Marcus Garvey, not only, well, he did appeal to one white institution, which actually, which is actually oddly, it sounds like he's a total sellout, but no, it's completely consistent, which was the Ku Klux Klan. He had at least negotiations. Did the Klan actually? I know they met. I don't know if the Klan ever gave him any money, but the idea was to repatriate blacks to Africa, which eventually became Liberia. And he met with the Klan to help. So I'm just going to say, like, you can correct the details there, but like the two nationalists, right? The white nationalists in the form of the Klan and the black, they get along in that particular way. It's like they agree to live separately.
Absolutely.
Which is something people can't wrap their head around, but it makes perfect sense.
And this is the second wave of the Klan. So we're trying to stop you from voting. We will kill
this
you. This is the big Klan.
This is the 1920s Klan, million members in
that's
it.
That's right, 6 million members. Okay. And speaking of Detroit, 1921, what happens in Detroit? There's a write-in candidate from the Klan that almost wins the mayorship.
Oh, hell yeah.
So it's huge.
Huge, yeah.
So that's the kind of the second wave of black nationalism. And then obviously the third wave on the most recent form of black nationalism in the 20th century is when you see the emergence of people like Malcolm X, the Black Panther Party,
Nation of Islam,
the New African Republic, Pan-Africanists, folks, us.
And the Shrine is part of that wave.
And the Shrine is a part of that wave. Mm-hmm. And these are boomer black nationalists who want to create their own neighborhoods and institutions in their own image. And even if that means violently, like even if that means, so, you know, one of the things we've talked a lot about is the mythology of black people being these kind of these passive, nonviolent
victims.
No, everybody owned guns. King's bodyguards owned guns. Man. Like, multiple guns.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, and black nationalists were very, very demanding of that. We have the right to protect ourselves, create our own neighborhoods, our own communities, our own institutes. So I come from that. I mean, that's where I come from. I don't come from a household that said, ask white people for anything. I came from a household that said, black people can self-determine. They have their own agency. They can do for themselves what they want. They don't have to ask anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And they can take it if necessary, and they can take it by force.
Yep.
So
what a radical idea.
That's why, in this area of kind of, you know, this era of, you know, kind of what we were talking about earlier, performative woke, you know, woke. I don't have that.
Wokeness.
Like, I don't have, you know, it's just, I didn't have that to get rid of. So, you know what I'm saying? It's like, I don't have to unlearn that. Like, what are you talking about? Yeah. You know, it's like.
One point you told me your mother said something to you about white people. Like, what was her basic line about white people? What'd she tell you? Like, it wasn't like, go kill whitey, but it was something like, you told me that you simply didn't trust white people until you were like an adult, right?
My mother, you know, my mother growing up poor on the east side of Detroit in the Brewster's Projects, she saw a lot. And I think a part of her appeal, a part of what made the Shrine attractive to her was because my mother used to tell me stories about Jewish merchants who used to come to her house and like sell inferior products and, you know, to her, you know, my mother would talk about how when she was at Cass, which was a predominantly white high school in the 1960s.
Back then, yeah.
Yeah, you know, they treated her horribly. I mean, it was the white teachers would call her names. My mother became a math teacher. She was a brilliant you know, math teacher. And a big part of that, you would appreciate this, I'm not sure if I ever told you this, was because my grandfather, although he was a, this is my mother's father, mm-hmm. while he was working for Chrysler, he was also doing what many black people did in the 1920s. He was running numbers.
Mm. Agorist, and baby. He was an agorist.
And so all of my aunts and uncles were gamblers, right? And so my mother was always around numbers, you know, so she was always around numbers because he was always around people who gambled. Hmm. And there was something called the dream book where, you know, you would actually go to a book. It's like a folklore. It's like, oh, you dreamed about fish, play 222. And, you know, it's like this was all around my mother. Numbers were constantly around my mother. Hmm. But there was also, you know, people who were trying to exploit folks. And so for her, all of her life, she never really had great interactions with white people because every time she interacted with somebody white, they were an authority figure or they were trying to exploit her.
Yep.
So she didn't trust white people. And she goes to a church that says you should not. Not only shouldn't you trust white people, you don't even need white people. Right. White people shouldn't even come in your circumference.
That's the best part. Yeah.
Exactly. And so for me growing up, she would say things like, I would say, you know, can I date someone who has a white, who's biracial? Mm. Nope, I don't want any white in-laws.
Not even that. Not even biracial.
Not even biracial. I don't want any white in-laws.
Hardcore.
My mother was, so we didn't do the whole, like, the white devil. We didn't use that terminology, but it was very clear that white people were not to be trusted. And this was not conservative white people or liberal white people. This was white people.
Damn. So if you had brought Halle Berry home, she would have been not.
If I would have brought Halle Berry home, my mother would have said, wow, she's pretty. That's it.
Wow. Okay, so now people have a sense of who I'm talking to. And they're still wondering what the fuck you're doing here. Or what the fuck I'm doing here. I'm in your house, not the other way around. All right, so we met, especially the way we met, it's especially weird. So, and you know what? I'm not even sure, like, if I've ever really, like, drilled down with you on this, like, why. But I love it. So you found my book, Renegade History of the United States.
I didn't even find the book. I found a review.
I
read the book later.
Right.
I just liked what you were saying. Like, the review was like, I was like, oh, this is amazing. No. So what happened was I was reading a review. I think it was HuffPost.
Okay.
That did the review, mm-hmm. your book. And I was a, so this is 2011, was it?
Yeah. 10, 11.
10,
yeah.
10, 11. Mm-hmm. So I am a year out from completing my dissertation. And I was going through a divorce. And I took a year and a half off from writing. I just wasn't in an emotional place to finish my dissertation. Mm-hmm. And my dissertation was about race and religion. Race, religion, and radicalism in Detroit during the interwar period. It's American history, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm reading a book called A Renegade. I'm writing a dissertation about renegades. Mm-hmm. And this book comes along, The Renegade, you know, History of America, and it's review. And I don't even think the review was...
I think you're talking about, actually, it was my piece. I was publicizing it. It was like,
yeah, yeah.
I kind of did my like story of myself getting fired.
That's right.
But
that's then, exactly.
But
what
I summarized
it was.
The book, yes, in it. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I completely identified with. So there are two reasons why I identified with you. One was because before I got to Northwestern for graduate school, I was in seminary at ITC. And my black professors at ITC always said, you do not need sources that are standard dominant sources. Go to the most obscure mm-hmm. sources because they can tell stories mm-hmm. that you know what I'm saying? It was like, you have permission to do that. You don't have to quote from Ricoeur or Plato. Like, you can go to other sources. There are other people who have narratives. So that's one of the reasons why I identify. Mm-hmm. And as I said before, that notion of having permission to do something was, when I read that, there was a courage that you had. Hmm. There was a level of courage.
Oh, thank you.
That that
seriously,
you had
thank you.
To be able to stand before a group of folks who kind of thought one way and take the blows, yeah. right?
It's kind of like Jesus.
Well, yeah, I mean, well, here's the thing, like my all my life growing up with parents who were activists, they were taking blows.
Yeah.
They were paying the consequences for their beliefs.
Yeah.
You know what yeah. I'm saying? You paid the consequences for your beliefs. There was a courage in that. And so I was like, I don't give a fuck if this is a white boy. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is like...
You were like, Thaddeus, that sounds right. like he might be a
but
brother.
I'm also, but you're also an academic, and I'm an emerging academic, mm-hmm. or at least thought I was trying to be an emerging academic. Mm-hmm. We're both writing about renegades in American mm-hmm. history, you know? And so I completely identified with it. You know, for me, it kind of gave me permission to look at alternative sources and alternative points of view and perspectives. And I think that's when I reached out to you and gave you and said, hey, man, I love what you're doing. And on top of that, I think it's really important for me to say this because I don't know if we opened up. I've been a high school teacher for over 20 years.
Right.
And I teach history. So one of the things that I do is, yes, I adopt all the common curriculum core standard, but I don't use any sources in my classroom outside of the mandatory textbook. All of the sources that I use are from people that I know. Because at the end of the day, I can reach out to you. This is not the first day that you talk to my class. You've talked to my class before. Mm-hmm. I've sent you pictures of kids who are using your text.
I know.
I use my friends who are scholars and writers and academics in my classroom because I want these ideas to be explored. But I also want to be able to say to students, these are real people. You don't have to fucking worry about old dead folks who've written these books that shitty text. No, let's use folks who are alive who can reach out and talk to and engage.
Talk to them.
And talk to them.
Right.
I never had a history teacher like that. I never had a history teacher who said, this was written by somebody I know mm-hmm. who's smart and intelligent. And by the way, we can actually talk to them.
Right. It's like your the artist too, right?
Exactly.
You actually have relationships with a lot of them.
Yeah.
And that's really important for you.
It's really important for me. And to me, it's a model of education that we should take seriously. Why do we have to constantly read from people who are not, why can't we engage with people who are alive?
I didn't think we were going to talk about pedagogy, but this is interesting. So basically it's like a living pedagogy living sources, right?
Living sources. And here's the thing, like one of the things that I always say is academic historians are one branch of historians. And the hegemony of the academy does not even allow for church historians and local historians and music to even go to those conferences. They don't have voice in those conferences. Mm-hmm. I mean, they keep that shit tight. Mm-hmm. Like, this is us. And we are the people who are determining what high school students and college students read. No. That's not how it works.
Yeah.
That's not how it works at all. I want people who've been fired. I want people who are, who we can reach out to at local and local neighborhood. Like, I want historians and thinkers you to be able to reach and touch them and say, hey, this stuff is alive and these people are alive and they're writing and engaging these ideas. And so, yeah, pedagogically, that's what I do in every single class that I teach. And I use all my friends. I mean, some people I don't know as well, but I always try to incorporate my friends. And here's the thing, too. I mean, just on a practical level, you get some money out of it. you know what I'm saying? Like, it's like I used to teach. We have a mutual friend in Shane Lee who's been on the podcast.
Yeah.
I taught a religion and popular culture course in 2011 or 12 at Emory University summer. I used Holy Mavericks. Mm-hmm. We ordered 50 copies of it. You know what I'm saying? That's Shane's book.
That's like, what this is all about, really. It's just friends help each other. You and I are just helping us. No, I know. Totally, man.
I'm not apologizing.
Why not? No, because Shane's brilliant and his book's brilliant and he should be taught.
Trust me, if I can get Renegade History to be adopted by Evanston Township.
Good luck with that, brother. So when I walked into your class today, it was lit. Like, those kids were on fire. I mean, I had to shut them up constantly. They wouldn't stop talking.
And tell them what time it was.
Right, which is a good problem to have. It's much better than when they're too quiet. But you clearly are doing something very right in that classroom because they were super comfortable with you, mm-hmm. even though you're very imposing in a lot of ways, intellectually and otherwise. And they didn't, but there was perfect respect for you too. It wasn't like they were disrespecting you, but I just thought it was a brilliant classroom. Just the vibe you have created in there.
Yeah,
I've never witnessed in high school. Maybe it's this elusive living sources as part of it. I'd never thought of that. That's great. All right. Back to me though. Much more important, much more interesting. That's what people are here for. Mm-hmm. So, I was shocked. So I see your name. I think you reached out on Facebook, maybe.
Yeah, it was Facebook.
Okay. And I was shocked. First of all, I saw your name. I was like, oh, this is going to be trouble. Because I had just written this book in which I argue that slaves were culturally and in other ways psychologically freer than whites. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, my publisher said, okay, we are not going to mention that chapter ever in any of the...
Really?
Yeah, I didn't tell you this? Yeah, they said, no, we're not even going to mention it in the media. When you do interviews, don't even talk about that chapter. I said, why? It's my best chapter. It's my most... I think it's the best thing I have in that book. And they said, because all that's going to happen is people are just going to reduce it to this. Thaddeus Russell argues that slaves were free and that, and you'll be dead. And so I was very nervous, you know, after it was published. I always assumed, hoped, I guess, that black people, if they actually read the damn thing, would see.
Well, but you also have to understand I'm a trained historian and theologian.
Yeah.
What you said.
That usually doesn't help me with people. You know what I mean? Like, academics do not like me.
But in Albert Rabiteau, who teaches at Princeton, slave religion, he says what you're saying.
Oh, I know.
Slaves are free.
Oh, I know.
Like, I mean, like, all of the... I'm coming from two historically black colleges that, and here's the thing. I went to, my professors were not lightweights. I mean, these are people who are reading from sources in Moreland Spingarn Library. For those of you who don't know, Moreland Spingarn is the largest repository of black authors and writers since, I don't know, the 19th century, it's, everything.
Yeah. That and the Schomburg
and the
New
Schomburg
York. Those
and
are the
New
two.
York.
Every American, not just African American, but any American historian needs to know those
needs
two
know
places.
Those two
those are incredibly important archives.
So yes. I'm not taught by lightweights. What you're talking about is history. It ain't, you didn't make it up. This is not. You're not
I
making.
Like,
shit
I like to think.
Up.
Yeah.
You know. So I found that the least controversial. I found the Martin Luther King stuff the least controversial. Like, it was just like, no, this is...
That's the shit that got me fired, was the Martin Luther King stuff.
But that's what I'm saying.
Saying, like, he was puritanical got me fired. Talking about Sweet Daddy Grace and the fact that he had long nails and that he had a lot of good dancing in his churches and that he was stereotypical in certain ways, they couldn't stand that.
If you've read any basic text from Martin Luther King... Martin Luther King wrote 5 books. Mm-hmm. Just read his shit. You ain't got to read other people. Just read Why We Can't Wait. you don't have to look far to find the you just echoing, you know, what folks have said about themselves. What you wrote in that book was what slaves were saying about themselves. What you wrote about Martin Luther King was what Martin Luther King said about himself.
He was a conservative culturally.
That's what he was saying about himself.
He was a cultural conservative.
And he was a cultural reactionary. He was a cultural conservative who comes from a context of an institution that's socially conservative.
The black church.
And the black church is not a prophetic institution.
What do you mean by that?
So.
Because I know that's a word that gets thrown out a lot, especially in like black theology. Cornel West is always using that, and I never know exactly what that means.
So Cornel West's first book that he writes is called Prophesy and Deliverance, an Afro-American Revolutionary
I never know what he meant, but I never knew.
What he's doing is he's taken liberation theology's interpretation of the Old Testament prophets, right?
Okay.
The Jeremiads, right? The folks who indicted the society in which they lived, and they said God is going to have judgment on them, right? Mm. So the Jewish invention of the prophetic is a tradition. It's a tradition of prophets who stand before the people and say what's wrong with the society. They're saying this is the cultural, social, political, and economic reality that you're living in. And the powers that be are creating these conditions. But God has something to say about it. That's all the prophetic tradition is.
Okay.
The prophetic tradition basically says that God is on the side of the oppressed. And he has something to say about it to the people. Now, here's the thing. Many people have said the institution, the black church, as if there is one black church, is a church that says this all the time, that critiques. No, the church doesn't do that.
No.
Most black churches in American history were assimilationists.
Oh, in that way. Yeah, yeah.
They weren't prophetic. They weren't critiquing the status quo.
Well, they were assimilationists, but weren't most, at least by the, certainly after World War II, weren't most at least calling for civil rights?
Yeah, but that ain't prophetic.
Okay, why not?
Because that's saying we want to be integrated into the society. We just want access to voting and democracy, but we don't want any radical change. The prophets of the Old Testament were saying, no, the whole society.
Oh, really? Oh, I see.
You see what I'm saying? The prophetic is not...
Is radical.
We want reform. We want to transform this whole damn
thing. Now, of course, a lot of people would say that the civil rights movement was radical by giving black people inclusion and first-class citizenship, but not people with a black nationalist lineage, not people with a radical lineage like me either, right? Okay, I gotcha. So in other words, it's a full transformation of society.
It's a full transformation of society.
That we're talking about, that civil rights movement did not call for, clearly, right?
It did not call for that.
They called for inclusion. Inclusion. Right.
So Martin Luther King is not doing something that's...
Then again, people would say King was also kind of a socialist, so he was radical in that way. But I get you. I mean, he clearly explicitly, as anybody who knows my work knows, explicitly calling for black people to adopt white people's culture. He said that straight up.
Yeah, he said that, but he also said that black people need to be integrated into democracy. Yep. That this democratic, he had faith in democratic institutions.
American democratic institutions.
Yep. That's not radicalism.
Correct. Gotcha.
And the black church was lock stock with that. The black church, quote unquote, sure. Putting air quotes.
Yeah.
So what you have, and this is what I argued when I wrote my dissertation. I said individual preachers, clergy, laypersons were radical. The church as an institution was not. And it has never been.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you have had individual churches like the Shrine of the Black Madonna, like Trinity United. But the black church as an institution writ large has never been a transformative prophetic institution.
Okay.
Ever.
Right. Yeah. It's always been really the center of what's now called respectability politics.
Absolutely.
The black church, right? The stuff that gets criticized now is respectability politics comes pretty much entirely out of the black church over the last 60 years.
But let me say this too, because there's a flip side of that.
Okay.
While the black church is one of the major purveyors of respectability politics, it's also culturally responsible for American popular culture. Because the vast majority of singers, artists, even performative queerness comes out of the black church.
Let's talk about you.
So on one side, you have this very conservative, theology, while at the same time, you have this liberatory space where black queer folks are testing out and measuring out music and dance and liturgy and dress and, all this other stuff. So that's why I love studying it, because there are these two kind of contradictory poles that exist. So while on one hand, we can critique the politics of it, but the culture of it, I mean, come on. And obviously we know that the music comes from the blues, but the music comes from the blues. But what happens is when Thomas Dorsey, who's the father of gospel music, he's Georgia Tom, and he comes from Georgia to Chicago, right? To Pilgrim Baptist Church right here on the South Side, 15 miles away from here. And he becomes the music minister. He leaves the juke joint on Saturday night. His wife dies, and he says, "No, precious Lord, take my hand." And he becomes the music minister at Pilgrim, Baptist Church. He uses the same chords from the Hammond B3 organ. He doesn't change the music at all.
Yep.
So when we talk about Whitney Houston and Michael Jackson and Prince and all of these folks that we love, and hell, before that, Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry, all these folks come from... their cultural performances come out of the black church.
They learned how to
James Brown is not the first person to do the splits.
That's right.
They were doing that in black churches.
They learned how to sing and dance and move and talk.
And talk.
In the church. That's right.
So it's an interesting space.
It's funny. I mean, I always sort of knew that on one level, but I never stated it the way that you just did. I always just say, black culture is largely responsible for American popular culture, which it is, but you're right. It's more specific than that. It actually comes out of the church, the black church.
And
I mean, I'm thinking just right off the top, I'm thinking this connects a lot of stuff together because about Cornel West's church, the organist was Sly Stone in Cornel West's church in Sacramento of all places. I mean, it goes on and on the list. I can't even think of a great black, is there a great black musician artist who didn't come out of the church?
Nope.
I mean, hardly, if any. Maybe what about Miles? He's the only one maybe.
Yeah, but here's the thing.
He's kind of classically trained.
Yeah, but he's classically trained, but he's also an instrumentalist. So, I mean, most of the vocalists and singers are coming.
That's right.
But, I mean, even somebody like a John Legend, right? I mean, he's playing in the AME church.
Clearly.
So, like, all these folks are coming out of the black church. But I want to say this I'm going to repeat this. The black church is a queer space.
This is really important, and this is completely correct. Yeah, go on.
Well, when it comes to the public kind of cultural performances of folks in drag,
yep,
burlesque shows, mm-hmm. Ballrooms.
Totally true.
The dress, mm-hmm. the way in which people are moving, yeah. the type of music, the sweat, the dance.
The exuberance.
The exuberance. Yeah. It all comes from the black church.
The joyfulness.
So there's a freedom. You know, so here's the black church on one hand restricts the body, right? Because it's puritanical, right? Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's the only place.
It lets it loose.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is kind of cliched, but like, you know, just go on Sunday. It's a great thing. Great field trip.
Yep.
For you and whoever you want to take with you. And it doesn't matter. I don't care if you're black or white. Just do this. Go to a white church and then go to a black church. And it should, you know, go to a black Baptist church and a white Baptist church, you know, mm-hmm. white Methodist church.
Do
and then
what
black...
W.E.B. Du Bois did.
Yeah. I did it in college. I had a Bible class. That's what we did. And it was just shocking.
W.E.B. Du Bois was the preeminent black thinker at the turn of the 20th century. I had never been to a black church.
Because he's from...
He's from the suburbs
from
of
Barrington.
Boston.
No, not even. No, he's from the Berkshire Mountains. Yeah, Barrington.
And he goes to his black church and he... It's and he writes about it. He might as well have been from Poland because he writes about it like the preacher, the friend. He does it. He's blown away.
Yep.
He doesn't know what to do with it.
Yep.
He knows there's something there. Right. He gets that this place is a special place. He's a sociologist. He knows he's trained. Well, he's actually a sociologist before the field. Yep. You know, he doesn't know even the field of sociology.
He invented sociology.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So he knows it's special. He knows something is happening. But he can't put his finger on what is actually, you know, what's informing these bodies and that are moving and why are they so free and mm-hmm. what's going on here? Mm-hmm. What's going on with this music? He can't place it. Mm-hmm. And so his experience is a lot like the experience of people who go to the black church for the first time. But I would say if you don't want to go to a black church, go to a black gay ballroom and then go to a black church. Yep. And you'll see how it feels very, very similar.
Oh, yeah. The chorus leaders are always gay men these days, right?
Absolutely. Historically have been.
And the singers often are, you know, especially mm-hmm. the men. But yeah. And then the queens, drag queens, they definitely, the black drag queens who I've written about, who really founded the drag mm-hmm. scene in this country. People don't know this. People like Little Richard was one of the founders of what is now RuPaul's Drag Race. But just the entire drag scene.
The number one drag
was
queen.
Was mostly black.
The
originally.
Number one drag queen in American popular culture in 2019. Comes from the black churches in New Orleans, and that's Tyler Perry.
Oh yeah,
and the Madea character.
Right, right. Shane Lee's subject. That's right. Yeah, there's a yeah. I hadn't thought about that exactly. I mean, I knew about the queer element of the church, of course, but I hadn't thought about how directly the connection is between that and pop culture.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Oof, okay. Damn, man, it's been an hour. Covered everything. Okay.
Do we want to talk about Born in the Struggle? Or you want to go somewhere else?
No, let's... Yeah. So, yeah, Born in the Struggle. So, you have made this movie that you need to release.
Yeah, man. I do.
Because you told me it's done.
It's done. So, the movie is essentially just... It's... The movie is really my desire to understand my generation, Generation X. And... the subset of us, those of us who are raised by activists. It's just my desire to understand.
Black nationalists.
Yeah, black radicals.
So
black
I'm
radicals.
A red diaper baby. You're a black diaper baby,
exactly.
I guess. Or a black
or
and
red,
green,
black, and green.
Red, black, and green diaper baby.
But yeah, so there's a cadre of folks who, some you know, some you don't know, your audience knows and some you don't know, who are raised by black radicals. Mm. You probably know the name Ta-Nehisi Coates. You probably know the name Raz Baraka, the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, one of the largest cities in America, raised by a black nationalist, Amir Baraka. Mm-hmm. You probably have heard of Fred Hampton Sr., who was killed by the Chicago police in 1969. I interviewed his son, Fred Hampton Jr. In other words, there's so many of us who were born in the late 60s and early 70s. And some of us were very conscious of what our parents were doing. Some of us saw it, remembered it, remember the police running through our homes, being arrested, thrown in jail, being beaten because we were going up against the state. This was not the civil rights movement. You know, this were people with guns and bombs. Mm-hmm. These were people who were
Assata Shakur, holding up. What'd you do? What are they called? The trucks, the
Brinks truck.
Brinks trucks, yeah. Armored cars. Yeah, armored cars,
but yeah. But also you got to understand too. Black nationalists are also emerging on college campuses and are being taught they're reading books that were dangerous because this was the Cold War. So they're reading the Green Book, the Red Book, they're reading very, very strong critiques of capitalism. And
the Black Panthers started out, which was, that was my home team. Yeah. Their headquarters was like right near where we live.
But they're on campus.
But they're distributing. Distributing Mao's little red book on the campus of UC Berkeley, exactly. Which is how everybody felt about them.
So the state had a problem with that, clearly, mm-hmm.
Well, no, not that. They had a problem with the Panthers patrolling the streets with rifles over their shoulders, right?
Definitely.
That was a little more provocative.
Well, I would say the state had a problem with communism.
But niggers with guns, I think, was much more of a problem
for
them.
That's
why they passed the first gun control law in this country.
Ronald Reagan, right?
That's right.
So anyway, I wanted to explore, what was it like growing up in a household where your parents were on the front lines, mm-hmm. and they were confronting the state in these ways? And so now that we're Generation X people in our 30s and 40s, how do we reflect on those times? What did it mean for us growing up? How did it shape our politics? How did it shape our understanding of the world? Were we traumatized by it? Did it make us radicals, conservatives, liberal? Like, all of that. I didn't set out with an agenda. Like, I just wanted to talk, all of these folks. So I interviewed about 15 people and ran around the country for about 3 years. And then I spent another year editing. And it's a 59-minute documentary called Born in the Struggle. And Dick Gregory's daughter, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Paul Coates, who's a black, his father was a black member of the Black Panther Party, Mira Rock, as I said. Elaine Brown's daughter, Erica Abram.
Elaine Brown was the head of the Black Panther Party, briefly.
Yes.
Wrote a very famous book about that. Right?
A man by the name of Stokely Carmichael, who changed his name to Kwame Ture. I interviewed his son, Bokar Ture.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Wow. Bokar is in the film. Great interview, too.
Man, Stokely Carmichael was something else, yeah.
Absolutely.
If anybody's seen Eyes on the Prize, you'll know these names. A lot of these names, anyway.
A lot of these names. And, of course, that's like I said, Fred Hampton Jr. Yep. I interviewed him. And then I interviewed some of my peers growing up from the Shrine of Black Madonna. Mm. I interviewed... Aisha Shahida Simmons, whose parents were black Vietnam War activists, mm-hmm. But they were also black nationalists, and Imani Perry, who's a professor at Princeton, who has an interesting story because her mother and her mother was an activist, and she's from Birmingham, Alabama. So her mother comes out of the civil rights movement,
I didn't know that.
But her mother met a Jewish man who was radicalized and decided to teach at a black college called Miles College in Birmingham, Alabama. Okay. And so Imani Perry was raised by her stepfather, a white Jewish dude from Brooklyn.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, absolutely. Who was a communist, So, who's a communist and black nationalist. It's interesting, So like her own politics are shaped by this. So it's a really interesting kind of, examination of who we are. Now, the outcome is that many of the children of radicals, black radicals from the 60s, do share their parents' politics, but they're not activists like their parents.
Okay.
And that's the difference. And a part of that is because of what they saw. They saw their parents going to jail.
Yeah.
They saw guns. I interview Orkia Lumumba, whose father, Chokwe Lumumba, was a big time black nationalist in the new Republican African Party.
Yeah.
He was also Tupac's lawyer.
Really?
Yeah. Chokwe Lumumba was Tupac's lawyer. But I interview her and she said, by the time I'm 11 years old, the police had come into our house and raided our house so much I slept with a knife under my pillow. She was 11.
Damn.
You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. how do you process that as a kid? Mm-hmm. And one of the things I always say is it's hard to be a revolutionary and a great parent.
This is what I was going to ask you. So I wanted to ask you this, which has nothing to do with politics, or it's not really about politics, not about ideology. It's not about history. It's not about the things we've been talking about. It's about the personal consequences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The psychological consequences, the emotional consequences of being one of us, actually, because this applies to anybody, I think, who was born in a radical family, mm-hmm. which could apply even to a radical religious family, like, you know, Mormon polygamist sect or something, right? Mm-hmm. For me, it meant tremendous neglect.
Yeah.
So my mother and father and stepfather were way more interested in Leon Trotsky and socialism and the proletariat and the people, than they were in me and my brother. And I was going to ask you this, because you and I have never really talked about this, but like, what did you experience that, or did any of the subjects of your film experience that?
I'll start off with the subjects. All of them experienced it on certain levels. Some experienced it with very traumatic consequences. Yeah. One of the things about that's very consistent with all of our stories, is including yours, is being left alone, yep. or being with other people.
Yeah.
Whether they're family members or friends of the party,
comrades.
Or friends of the comrades. Mm-hmm. And
brothers and sisters, in your case, maybe.
And some of these people were predators.
Okay. That kind of predator.
That kind of predator. Or they were neglectful.
I dodged that.
Yeah. They were neglectful, you know, whatever. But, you know, but there was a level of trust, yeah. you know, that our parents had of other folks to watch us. So a lot of people paid that type of consequence. The other consequence was just abandonment, like not knowing where your parents are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kiese Lehman, who teaches at University of Mississippi, I interview him in the film. He says, sometimes my mother was late. And he said, well, not say late, I mean days late. Mm-hmm. you know, imagine mm-hmm. like, you know, you get mad at your, you forgot to pick me up and it's 20 minutes. No, days late.
Damn.
You know.
And that was because of politics, not because of a drug problem?
It's because of politics.
Damn. Because I've heard of that
it's with drug problems. It's because I am committed to the people.
Yeah, I know.
And the movement needs me.
I know.
Right?
I know.
So that's the subjects. I would say for me, it was a lot of uprooting. I was never at home. I was always over our aunt's house or uncle's house or this, you know. And some of that was... And some of the stories behind why I was there was, oh, we're going out of town. No, you're not going out of town. You're going to a protest. You're going to a march. You're going to a rally. You're going, you know what I'm saying? Or, you know, or there's a possibility of us going to jail. I mean, it's stuff like that. It was like, I didn't hear that. My parents didn't, they protected my sister and I from that. But, you know, I remember, I remember stories about my father going to jail. And him lying to the judge, like, if you send me to jail, my kids won't eat. And I didn't know this. Like, I didn't know that stuff. But, you know, that's the personal consequences of being raised by radicals. Here's the thing about radicals that people have to understand is many radicals have either an inherent distrust of the state, legitimate distrust of the state, where they just avoid the state, or they're directly confronting the state.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Those are the ones you don't want to be a child of.
Exactly. And you're going to pay the consequence for that.
Yeah.
So, and unfortunately, while, yeah, parents do pay a direct consequence for, the children pay a huge consequence for. And psychologically, I remember one of the things that I remember as a child is wanting my father to come to my baseball games.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something simple, you know what I'm saying? Like
believe me. Yes.
You know, it's like,
yes.
And I remember one time he came to my baseball game, and after the game, my coach said, you never threw the ball that hard ever in practice in a game, but you saw your dad there.
Yep.
And, you know, so it's just like something as simple as that. It's like, I just wanted my dad to come to my baseball game. But no, you know, you have other commitments. You have these strong commitments. It's
okay. So you carried that basic ideology, right, with you into Howard.
Yes.
Definitely. And through Howard.
I would say I was a black nationalist all the way up through probably junior year-ish of Howard.
Okay.
What
happened?
I'll tell you what happened, because I remember it vividly.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first week in May of 1992. And for those of you who don't know, 1992 will go down in history in Los Angeles, California, because there was something called the Los Angeles riots. And we were organizing. I belonged to an organization, a student activist organization, Black nationalist organization at Howard University. And we were organizing to protest. And we're in Washington, D.C. So what's the symbol of power? It's the White House, right? So we go down to the White House and we are protesting against police brutality that's happening in Los Angeles. And I remember going down to the White House, shouting and screaming all of these slogans. And in the back of my mind, the only thing I can think of was, this is the first week in May. And what happens almost every single college campus the first week in May? Final exams. And I said to myself, my parents have sacrificed, fought, literally sacrificed, you know, literally. And I'm sitting up here, not anywhere near a college campus to take my final exams. And I'm shouting at the White, they can't even hear me, you know, like, you know, and I'm shouting at the White House about an incident that happened in Los Angeles. And I should be taking my fucking final exams, you know.
Wait. You were born in the struggle, and you were struggling. Why would they not support that? Wouldn't they rather you do that than take some chemistry
at that
exam?
Particular point, at that particular point, I think my parents would probably say, bravo, but take those damn final exams. Okay. We didn't pay all that money for you to go. And it just hit me.
Yeah.
That's the moment that I said, you know what? While I appreciate the sentiments of what we're trying to do,
I need a job.
I need a job. I need a job. Right. So I would say that's where my Black nationalism came to almost a halting screen.
And you decided to have a super practical major, which was film.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So yeah. So that's where, and you know, we didn't get a chance to really talk about Howard, but that's early 90s Howard was in late 80s early 90s Howard was a really interesting space because there was a lot going on. You had the height of the crack war, which I saw in Washington, D.C.
Oh yeah,
you had the height of the crack war. When I got to Howard, there was a guy who smoked crack in his hotel named Marion Barry. It's why he's the mayor of Washington, D.C. That was happening at the same time. You had George H.W. Bush, who was in office, who was drumming up war in Kuwait. You also had, obviously, you had the, you know, police brutality, you had gangster rap, you had all of this. You kind of had this nexus of all of these things that were happening.
You had Public Enemy.
I had Public Enemy. They were Public Enemy was the homecoming performers at 1990 Crampton Auditorium. Like, so all of these things were happening. And then you had this this kind of ideology that comes out of Black cultural nationalism called Afrocentricity.
Yeah.
Which is a combination of like symbolic embrace of Africa with Black nationalism, with embrace of conspiracy theories, with this kind of romanticism of what Black identity is.
For those of you who are fans of the Hoteps,
yes,
that's exactly what we're talking about. Exactly. That they come out of that.
So all of this was happening at this time. And I said, you know what? This is, I saw what this did to my parents. I'm good.
Did you?
Absolutely. That I mean, it was just like a movie. It was like, yep, this is, I know what this looks like because I saw it with my parents.
Self-preservation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or at least wanting a better life.
Wanting
I guess,
a better
for
life.
Yourself. Yeah, me too. Took me a little longer than you. You know, I went all the way through, I think, I was about 2 years into grad school before I even had a second thought about socialism. But then it started to turn real fast. But yeah, that's so okay. So then
but the commonalities, it started to turn real fast. That's the thing. But it doesn't take, once you got it.
Yeah, once there's like one little seed in there, a bunch of the garden grows pretty fast of Garden of Freedom, liberation from the church or the shrine, whichever it is. So, okay. So then after Howard, what'd you do?
After Howard, I went back home to Detroit and tried to apply for graduate film school and didn't get accepted. And my mother, I had to move back home. And my mother said, well, you need to get a job. And I said, well, I don't have a plan B. I want to be a filmmaker. And she said, what I want you to do is, because my mother's a public school teacher. And my mother said, what I want you to do is get a job, substitute teaching. Because you can make some money, you can have some benefits. And while you're reapplying to graduate film school, you can sub. And I hated every single minute of substitute teaching. And then what happened was a teacher in the building got hurt in a car accident, and I ended up having to take over his eighth grade social studies class. And I became an uncertified teacher, full-time teacher in a classroom. This was early 90s where it was a major teacher shortage. Mm-hmm. So they were having these alternative teacher certification programs where they would allow you to stay in a classroom uncertified as long as you were working towards your certification. And at the end of that school year, I was like, I don't think I want to teach. And one of my colleagues came to me and he said, you know what? He said, you're 22 years old and I've never seen anybody take command of a classroom unprepared like you. I think you should reconsider this teaching thing. Mm-hmm. And I decided to apply to graduate school to get my master's degree in curriculum education with my teaching certification in history. And 24 years later, I'm still doing it.
Here's how badass you are as a teacher. I called you to your face in front of your class today a prison guard.
Yes.
And you didn't even care. Or maybe you might have even said
yes.
What
did the kids say?
What did they were like, uh-huh, yeah, we heard that before from Mr. Hill, from Dr. Hill, right?
That's right.
Something like that. You're like, oh, yeah, we talked about that before. So, you know, there is, you are a public school teacher, and people know what I think about those people. Mm-hmm. But see, I can be friends with one. Here's the thing. Yeah. You know why I'm friends with you, though. It's only because you're black.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, absolutely. Otherwise, I'd just be calling you a fascist prison guard.
Well, I mean, here's the thing.
But you subvert the shit out of that prison.
Absolutely.
You should see his classroom. I mean, I'm talking to the audience now. It is.
But
yeah.
But here's the thing. My kids don't have to sit in desks if they don't want. They can lay on the floor.
Yeah.
I don't give a shit.
They were all talking. They were all talking at you, to each other.
They can talk to me. They can. If they argued with you, they stayed after class and they challenged
they
you.
They really pushed. Argued with me. And you, know, you too.
And me too.
It's great.
I don't write detentions.
It's awesome.
I don't write them up. They can curse me out.
Even better. Can you talk about the kid who had the recent legal problem?
Yeah, I mean, I had a kid who was caught with, you know, some illegal substances. Here's the thing. I am not interested in policing, recreating the police state in my classroom. Mm-hmm. Because here's the thing, while the school system is definitely hugely problematic and resembles a prison, I can control my classroom.
Yeah, that's true.
So in my classroom, you don't get a referral. If there's disrespect, I identify it as such, and not defiance. I don't mind defiance. I don't mind challenging authority.
Right.
Challenge me.
Right.
I'm not the fucking authority on this.
Right.
I read some books. That's it. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? But there's a difference between defiance. We actually have an entire category in the system in the computer where defiance is a category where we can write you up. All of these categories, and there's all these categories of defiance. I never, ever, ever write my students up for defiance.
Wow. It's just like the army.
I don't want my students to not defy me. I want them to defy
me. Yep.
Right? I want them to challenge me. I want them to tell me when something is boring, when something is irrelevant. Hmm. I had a kid tell me, not about me, but about another teacher, why should I sit in the class when I'm smarter than the teacher? I said, you shouldn't.
That's right.
You know, so like for me, it's I recognize the system that I'm a part of. I mean, I do. I mean, I'm totally aware of it. But I also recognize what I can do.
Yeah.
And what I can do is to create in that tiny classroom, spaces of intellectual engagement, a freedom of challenging, status quo and ideas that are conventional. I can invite people who've been fired from, you know, academic institutions and who have radical podcasts into my classroom. Like I can do that, mm-hmm. And for me, all of my life's narrative informs my pedagogy. It informs, you know, the way in which I approach teaching. Yeah. So I don't, while there, I have some strong critiques of the system. My classroom, at least for the 43 minutes that my students are there, I try to make it a space where that doesn't reflect what they're actually dealing with in the school system and in some of their other classes.
You told me that if they're high, you tell them come in and relax.
Come in and relax.
And that's that.
I mean, so if a student is high off marijuana, am I going to write them up when I have 10 other students who are high off ADHD medicine. All the students are high. That's right. All the students are doped up.
Yeah, that's true. Not to mention the SSRIs. That's right.
I mean, I got kids who are on Xanax because they have depression and anxiety. Like, name a kid who's not on drugs in my classroom. Name one. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Do they exist? All of them are.
Damn, excellent point. Yeah. Hadn't thought of
that. So, like, I'm not going to single out the marijuana kid.
Right.
The marijuana kid may be the one that's most intelligent.
You get away with some shit. That's all I'm saying. You get away with some shit. I'm glad you do, because I have a place to speak in a public high school. But it's great. No, it's a thing. You can create some kind of liberated space even inside of there. At least you have. I've seen it. Let's.
I don't think I'm completely unique. I think other people, you know. Yeah. I'm not completely unique.
I mean, the other high school class I taught in.
Yeah, yeah.
Was similar to yours in Sacramento.
That's what I'm saying. Like, we're out there. We may be few, but right. we're out there.
All right. So back to you. Mm-hmm. and your narrative, the history. So, all right. So you became a teacher, became a prison guard.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
In Detroit. And then you moved here and got a job here, teaching here. Mm-hmm. All right. So I'm thinking about, again, our relationships with our parents respectively, right? And so for me, it was, you know, falling out of the church gradually as an adult. So once I got to grad school, I started reading the stuff that I thought I was supposed to read to become a good socialist and realized it wasn't my bag, or worse. And then I started to fish around for a new way of thinking about the world. I don't know. And I had to invent my own, basically. Invented my own worldview, my own ideology, which took a long, long time, and I'm still doing it. But for you, you know, just sitting here in this apartment full of pretty much only art created by descendants of Africans, right? I'm thinking maybe you haven't overthrown your lineage entirely. And what is your relationship with...
When you say overthrow my lineage entirely,
what do you mean? I have, right? So, like, I've renounced the whole damn thing. Like, ain't nothing about socialism I like. And ain't nothing about the whole... Or the people, like... I have nothing good to say about socialists or socialism, or for that matter, my parents, really. So, but you clearly, there's clearly a link between the present now in some way or another and your past, right? Because this is not necessarily black national, an expression of black nationalism, collecting African art.
Black culture.
African diaspora. So, and right. Mm-hmm. Well, what do you mean? Wait, what?
Well, I would say that the art that I have is reflects cultural tropes within the context of African American life.
Sure.
I mean, right. So that while there is a politics to that, I guess. What informs my desire is not some reclamation of, you know, of black nat. It's not even a reclamation of first of all, I buy the shit because it's nice. I like it. I like the way it looks.
It's aesthetically beautiful.
It's aesthetically beautiful.
As, I mean, people will look at the pictures, but there are many pieces in here which I would love to own, you know? But come on. I mean, there is a politics behind this, right? There's something.
The politics is curating it.
Why you don't have Matisse, but you have.
The politics is saying that there's. One of our favorite television shows is Good Times.
Yours and mine, yes.
Yours and mine.
Yeah, we talked. Yeah, and you have. Oh my God, that new piece you have, exactly. The sculpture, which is a TV that plays a loop of Good Times. Yes. Is my favorite one of your pieces.
But one of the things that I tell folks all the time about Good Times is the utter reductionism of James Evan Jr., JJ's character, that folks critique him and say he's a coon and he's a buffoon. And they miss completely what he was all about. James Evan Jr. was an artist. And what he did on that show has not been replicated since or before. He painted in his living room in a Cabrini-Green project.
That's right.
And what he painted was what he saw outside of his window when he walked down the block, when he turned the corner.
I forgot that.
I am simply replicating what James Evan Jr. was doing. And that is curating the experiences of people who live in these various neighborhoods. That's a pool hall piece right there. That's a dance hall piece right there. That's two black people making love. I can't go to the Art Institute on Michigan Avenue and find that.
Okay.
Like, I can't go to a black church and find this stuff. Who is going to create the stories of regular, everyday black people, right? Who's going to curate it?
As I said, I've never seen anything like this. I've never seen a museum like this.
That's what I'm saying.
Or a gallery, even.
So the politics of it is simply saying, tell the fucking story. Like honor the narrative and the varying experiences of black folks everywhere. Because who else is going to do it?
Mm-hmm.
If they're stealing a white dude's art, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And putting it in, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, there's no conscious political, I'm trying to be black. It's not that. I'm simply trying to say the experiences of people who look like me, you know, in these neighborhoods, we don't see, we don't honor, we don't privilege, we don't center. And I'm just curating. That's all I'm doing.
All right. Let me throw a concept at you and see what you do with this one. So I wondered if part of it was a sense of what is usually called race pride. Mm-hmm. Is that part of it? I've been meaning to ask you this for a long time. This could get ugly.
If there is, it's not conscious.
Okay.
And the only reason why I say that is because I'm not the pieces. So that's a Mardi Gras piece. I love Mardi Gras. I'm not thinking race pride. You know what I'm saying?
Okay, here's.
It's not conscious. That's what the point that I'm making is. Yeah. It's not. It could be, but it's not something that I consciously think about. And I don't have racial pride in the strict sense that people that think about. I do have an affinity towards African American cultural expressions. So I have an affinity for hip hop. I love it.
So do I.
Cornbread and fucking, like, you know, talking shit.
So do I.
You know what I'm saying? So, like, I take pride in. That's what I want to hold on to. But racial pride?
Yeah. As if it, in other words, like, it's the claim that this thing belongs to you that was made by other people who may look like you, but you don't even know. Right? I'm not saying you're claiming that, but to me, that's what race pride is. And of course, people of all colors practice it, right?
Right.
I'm Irish, even though I live in Boston in 2019. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the Irish during the famine and the 18th, blah, 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 that's my people. No, it's not. It wasn't your experience, nor was the invention of whiskey. You don't get credit for that, you know? Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I see that a lot with everybody, including African Americans. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, hoping you don't take credit.
No, I mean, I don't. Like I said, I can't say it's a conscious thing.
Sure.
It's not something I think about. It's just not. I spent a lot of money on this shit.
I was going to ask you. I know you know what I'm saying?
And I don't think I'm doing some race pride. I don't. Okay. I think this is my fucking, damn, I got to pay this. You know, like, I'm thinking that it's nice. I want it. I can afford it, or I can't. And I try to figure out a way to afford it. Like, if race pride is on the list, it's way, it's down there somewhere. You know what I'm saying? It's like, but I would say I am definitely intentionally trying to curate the experiences, when I say the experiences, I mean some of the experiences that black folks had. There's not one experience, but, like, you know, that's what I'm trying to, that's what I'm conscious of. I know that I'm doing that.
Right.
I know that I am intentionally collecting art that reflects some aspect of the black experience. And I'm specifically collecting art from people who are of African descent. Like, that's very, I'm very conscious of that. Okay. And I own that. I don't, you know,
the critique that I just came to recently on this, and I was actually came from someone else, a friend of mine, but is the idea, I'd never thought about it this way until recently, because, you know me, I mean, one of the reasons we bonded was also my love for black culture. You know, it made it very easy. So I was the white guy who would love black culture, but also sort of support expressions of black pride also, because I love black culture. And so, this is a culture I love. If you as a black person, express pride in it, I'm with you because I love it. I don't express pride because it's not people who look like me. But then it was brought to my attention that is, first of all, it's just absurd to claim, you know, credit for or blame for anything that's been done by your ancestors. What people who express race pride do is, first of all, they only claim credit, essentially, mm-hmm. right? Somehow, like, John Coltrane mm-hmm. has something to do with you, or, you know, it doesn't matter which ethnicity it is, right? And the problem is they deny the bad stuff also in the mm-hmm. past. If you own the good stuff from your ancestors, you should also own the bad stuff, and no one does that.
Yeah.
But it's also, like, it's just... it's inherently limiting as a human being. It limits the, it's racialist or racist in a sense, in that way, right? It limits, I'm not saying this is what you're doing, but mm-hmm. it limits one's experience. It limits one's outlook, kind of like a nationalist. You're limiting mm-hmm. you're limiting who you're dealing with and what kinds of forms of culture you're interested in. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But I don't know how that relates to me.
Good.
Yeah.
Checking.
I mean, yeah,
I'm just checking.
I guess what I'm saying is, like, I don't,
you know the phenomenon I'm talking about, right?
Like, I do.
Our, but, like, this, you know, our people have done this, yeah. and my people have done this. It's like, yeah. no, you didn't do it. You weren't a slave, nor were, you know, my people. I'm not an indentured servant. My ancestors were.
Yeah.
My ancestors invented the jig, not yeah. me.
Yeah.
Right? And I, you know, and also, like, I'm an alcoholic, and so were a lot of Irish people, but there's no connection between the two.
Yeah. I think that's a legitimate critique. And I think a lot of things are born from that, right? Cultural appropriation,
totally.
For example.
Exactly.
Right. Right. I'm not a believer
right,
in
cultural. It's proprietary also.
It's proprietary,
yeah,
exactly. And there is an essentialism that
yes.
goes along with that.
Yes.
That says,
which is basically racism.
I am the arbiter. Right. I am the only person who can who's the arbiter of this particular
because
thing.
Of my race.
Because of my race.
Which is a construct.
I don't do that. So I'll give you an example.
I thought not. I was just checking.
I give you an example. So the black national, we talk about having a black nationalist card, you know,
mm-hmm.
I would say where black identity shows up outside of obviously these kind of cultural tropes that you see in here is I support black contemporary artists because I want black artists to have money. Because who else is going to give them money? It's a very kind of pragmatic thing in a sense, right? Mm-hmm. Most black artists, Basquiat.
Mm-hmm. Jean-Michel
Basquiat is, you know, had Andy Warhol. You know what I'm saying? Who gave him access to all of these. He's one dude.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously you have people like, you know, Kerry James Marshall now, you mm-hmm. know, but that's one.
Right. who have been funded.
Who have been funded. The vast majority of black artists are supported by black people.
Well, you know why? Because black people don't make art. Didn't you know this? They make music, mm-hmm. but they don't make what you collect.
Yeah.
We believe.
Right.
Yeah.
So getting back to what you were saying, racial pride is not, I don't know where that necessarily shows up in the way that you articulate it.
Cool.
I guess racial pragmatism, you know,
well, right behind your head is two bookshelves that are in the shape of the continent of Africa. Two.
Yes.
You got two of them.
Actually, three.
Three.
There's one right there.
And they're colored red,
black and green.
Right.
Right. That's right.
But all right. Jeez, no race pride. Fine. All right, you nationalist.
I said, no, I didn't say there's no race pride. I said there's no conscious.
I got you.
Pride.
No, I know. No, that's good. That's good. Very frank and honest. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
This is unregistered, man. All right. Born in the Struggle. So you finished it. When are you releasing it?
So I
what are you doing?
I'm going to.
We need
I have
this.
To, so, as a person who works with technology, you know, sometimes the audio doesn't
okay.
sound like you wanted to sound. Right. It's not as crisp as you wanted to sound. So that's what I need to do. That's the only thing I need to do because
okay.
everything else is done. So I'm going to release it. But I do want to say something to your audience that I think is important because I think it's full circle,
mm-hmm.
and that is we started this conversation talking about religion.
Yeah.
My next documentary project. Focuses on religion,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't focus on black nationalism
mm-hmm.
or black religious nationalism. It actually focuses on Generation X, black Generation Xers who are non-religious,
right.
who are non-theists.
Right.
And so I'm really, really excited about finishing up and releasing Born in the Struggle so I can start my next project because I think there is a dearth of material, whether they be books or films that talk about the post-soul generation of African Americans who were born after the Civil Rights Movement, who had unprecedented access to the market, and not simply the market, but the marketplace of ideas.
Right. Yep.
And some of those ideas have evolved into African American Generation Xers not believing in the in the institutions and the deities of their foreparents. And there is an entire growing number of out Black atheists, agnostics, free thinkers, and humanists. And I want to, I'm proud. No, I'm joking.
You can be proud of that.
No, but I'm excited about exploring the way in which they came to, you know, why they came to it, and how it impacts their view on the world.
Yeah, they think differently about politics. Coates is one. You're one. Yeah. There's quite a few. When we were talking about this today, it hadn't occurred to me, but you're right. I mean, so there's the civil rights generation, which is famously Christian, mm-hmm. right? And then you have since then.
You have Black radicals, which many of them were famously Muslim.
Muslim, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. At the same time. And then since then, you have their children and their children's children mm-hmm. who are, it hadn't occurred to me, but they're growing increasingly secular or almost entirely secular. Yeah. Well, like Shane's another example,
absolutely.
Right? Yeah, Shane Lee, right? Grew up not just in a church, but he was a fundamentalist mm-hmm. And is not at all now. But yeah, and that can affect your politics in a whole bunch of ways that are interesting, and your way of life and your way of thinking. Cool.
And it says something about the ways in which we must push back against this notion that all Black people think alike.
There you go.
All Black people have to think alike.
There you go.
You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So it's like this, you know, that is why the problems the Black church and the Black community are just, you know, they're not only constructs, but they're fundamentally problematic and flawed.
Yeah.
And I think one way to get at it is to explore the ways in which the divergent ideas in the Black community that exist. You know.
Thanks for bringing me here. Thanks for reaching out to me 10 years ago. Thaks for reading my book and thinking about it before you react to it. Thank you. Man. Thank you for collecting this beautiful art. Thank you for this.
Yeah.
And we'll probably do this again.
I appreciated that. My man.
Thank you.
My man, 50 grand.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To experience the new Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com. Thanks for listening.